B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, April 9th, 2020. Coming up in today's podcast, we will announce our first grant from the Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. A worthy listener who is our first applicant. And I want to open by highlighting a thought that occurred to me as I drove to the secret studio this morning. And I looked around and saw a man who's homeless with his entire belongings scattered around him on the sidewalk near the tennis court next to the park. And it drove home to me that the response to the pandemic of the coronavirus has pulled back the curtain on the economic caste system that is largely hidden from view here in the United States because we get so much propaganda from television. But it is a worldwide problem. And what we have seen revealed is the class culture that is based on a perception of value of the makers and the takers. That's a favorite saw of the right wing in this country, as they perceive that the people who support conservative economic values, the so-called free market, unrestricted global trade, trickle-down economics, are just victims of these leeches, who in fact are the modern-day serfs who generate their profits. And some of them are offshore and out of sight, but many of them are very much in view right here in the United States. So consider this. Based on the funding from Congress of the CARES Act, you recall that it included, I believe the number is $450 billion for the Federal Reserve to parcel out. And it comes with a multiplier effect. And I actually don't know how that works. It's some kind of voodoo economics. But basically, they're able to multiply the $450 billion into $4-plus trillion. And already, the Federal Reserve has announced that they are going to pump $2.3 trillion of that multiplied magic money through new and expanded programs. Now, they cited the now 16.7 million Americans who are jobless, but we know that they are creating a safety pad, a safety net, for greedy corporations, banks, and the properties of the 1% in this country. And we'll call them oligarchs because that gives a special thrill to listener John Zwiebel in Hawaii. And so what we're seeing is a new program to buy municipal bonds, expand corporate bond buying programs to include some lower rated and riskier debt. At the same time, on Capitol Hill, the White House and the Senate Republicans want to borrow more money to pump a measly $250 billion into the new loan programs, there are two of them, for distressed small businesses. Now, I actually don't object to this, but Mitch McConnell wants to cut it off right there. And the Democrats refused to play along. There was a limited session in the Senate, and under their rules, they can pass some things if there are no objections, if there's a unanimous consent for it, even if there isn't a quorum. But the Democrats, to their credit, have said, no, wait a minute. But to their discredit, they are simply asking for $100 billion for hospitals, a worthy target, and $150 billion for state and local governments. That's worthy, too, because their tax collections are going down and will go lower. But I don't see any reporting where the Democrats are demanding more money for the people in the lower caste who are most desperately affected. And The Guardian today focuses on a janitor in Kansas City, Mary P. Now, for years, she's been cleaning offices for a specific company that's not named in Kansas City. And they reclassified her job. She was once an employee with full benefits. And the article's not totally clear about this, but it appears she now works for a third party who contracts with the company that was once her employer, and her health benefits have diminished, her pay was lowered, and she has no job security. So when the layoffs began, Mary P. says, "They told me to go home. They'll call me if they need me. I won't get paid. The health insurance only lasts until the end of the month. I can apply for food stamps and unemployment, but it won't pay the rent. I'm really afraid of what happens if I get sick. I will just have to stay home. I can't afford to pay for a doctor." Now, that's just one anecdote. Then you go up one caste to union workers. And while they qualify for the extended unemployment with the $600 a week boost from the federal government, many of them will be losing their health care coverage at the end of April, or in some cases, at the end of May. And I believe Kansas is one of the 38 states that is part of the federal Obamacare exchange, the group of states who Trump unilaterally decided will not be allowed to open a new enrollment program for people to cop some subsidized health insurance during this unpredictable slowdown and shutdown of business in America. And a good piece from Jane Bradley, writing in the New York Times today, broadens our scope. We zoom out to look at the world economy, the world, first world, second world, third world impacts of this. And she opens with something we've covered here. Crates of masks snatched from cargo planes on airport tarmacs. Now, she doesn't mention that those were U.S. operatives. We don't know who the hell they were. But Germany explicitly said that there was a shakedown on the runway at an airport in Bangkok, where a plane load of masks was snatched from a plane that was headed for Germany and put on a cargo plane headed for the United States. And they greased with cash, suitcases of cash. Apparently, the airport workers and maybe some people from the company which had arranged to ship those masks to Germany. Accusations of modern piracy, she writes, against governments trying to secure medical supplies for their own people. And it's the first world, the U.S., the European Union, that has the cash and the muscle to try to pick up not just the PPE, but critical chemical components that are used in testing for this novel coronavirus. And we have an emerging picture of global wealth disparities. And the simple message is that these people don't matter. They're not as human as we are. And it's really distressing to see this play out, where potentially, because so far in Africa and in some parts of South America, there is not a huge outbreak of infections and death. It's somewhat based on global travel patterns. Oh, and by the way, I think it's coming up in the daily summary from Linda Lewis. But we've learned that the primary infections in New York didn't come from China. They came from Europe. And so, what is being revealed here? In naked ugliness, is that the developing world is being left to fend for itself. And I want to recommend a piece also in today's New York Times by Professor Walter Scheidel. He is a professor of classics and history at Stanford. And he takes us back to 1347, the bubonic plague that entered Italy on a few ships from the Black Sea. Can't blame the Chinese for that one. And he writes, the plague returned a decade later. Periodic flare-ups continued for a century and a half, thinning out several generations in a row. And because of this destructive plague, which devastated nations and caused populations to vanish, the entire inhabited world changed. He goes on, the wealthy found some of these changes alarming. In the words of an anonymous English chronicler, such a shortage of laborers ensued that the humble turned up their noses at employment and could scarcely be persuaded to serve the eminent for triple wages. But big landowners lobbied the English crown to pass the Ordinance of Laborers, which informed workers that they were obliged to accept the employment offered for the same measly wages as before. And that is a description of serfdom. And while it's modified by the industrial age, the digital age, it remains a moral outrage that the oligarchs, the people who rule the economies of the world, will not only survive but profit from this. And my globe-trotting journalist pal, Pepe Escobar, who provides the offshore insights that I consider so valuable, posted yesterday at Consortium News, and the headline reads, Who Profits from the Pandemic? And Pepe, he has a particular insight into the aims of China. And he offers some fascinating analysis. He starts by quoting Henry Kissinger, the anointed oracle gatekeeper of the ruling class. He writes, Dr. K is predictably scared. He claims that sustaining the public trust is crucial to social solidarity. He's convinced the hegemon should safeguard the principles of the liberal world order. Otherwise, failure could set the world on fire. And Pepe ticks off that the global aviation industry is a $2.7 trillion annual business, 3.6% of global GDP. Income losses for workers will range from $860 billion to an astonishing $3.4 trillion, especially across the global South. And a little later he writes, their experience spells out a long and difficult journey. As the rest of the world is in a coma, Liu Ting, chief China economist at Nomura in Hong Kong, stresses that China faces a 30% decline in external demand, at least until this fall. Later, he writes, the cryogenic state of the global economy spells out a vicious depression 2.0 and an unemployment tsunami. The plebs eventually reaching for the pitchforks and the AR-15s en masse is now a distinct possibility. Might as well start throwing a few breadcrumbs to the beggar's banquet. Pepe loves those rock and pop references. And he goes on, no one is fooled anymore by the Fed's magic quantitative easing powers or the acronym SALAD, all of these different programs that feed big banks, corporations, and the goddess of the market to the detriment of the average American. Oh, and then he bears down on Wall Street and BlackRock, the biggest money manager on the planet with tentacles everywhere, managing the assets of over 170 pension funds, banks, foundations, insurance companies. And they have been hired to advise the Treasury Department and the Fed. And he cites the profiteering of Georgia senator recently appointed and up for election for the first time this fall, Kelly Loeffler. You know, her husband, Jeffrey Sprecher, I guess it is the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange installed by Goldman Sachs. And she's now saying that it's just her political opponents and those damn liberals. She didn't do anything wrong. We only know that she got a briefing about the pandemic and the prospects for a severe recession. And she sold some stocks and bought others to profit from the misery of others. Pepe notes Bill Gates' dream for mandatory vaccination. He wants billions of doses to be enforced over the global South. And Pepe speculates it could be a cover to getting everyone a digital implant. And he cites a TED Talk that was, it's frequently referred to, that Bill Gates gave. Quoting Gates, "Eventually what we'll have is certificates of who's a recovered person, who's a vaccinated person, because you don't want people moving around the world where you'll have some countries that won't have it under control, sadly. You don't want to completely block off the ability for people to go there and come back and move around." A further quote from the billionaire from Microsoft. "So eventually, there will be this digital immunity proof that will help facilitate the global reopening." And then Pepe talks about the prospect of digital cash. And I've raised questions about how the House bill that was written for negotiation with the Republican Senate bill that ended up as the CARES Act had a clause that was deleted to pay the $1,200 advance on next year's taxes to Americans with a new digital currency. We'd never heard of it before. There's been no discussion, debate, detail. And I also want to recommend at Consortium News, Lee Camp, who's been on this podcast a couple of times. He is a very funny, serious comic. And with plenty of snark and sarcasm, he takes us into the view of Naomi Klein and the shock doctrine. He says, well, we have shocks to our lives, the economy, reality, families, careers. The pain of these shocks hits us in many ways, not the least of which is being forced to have sex while 6 feet apart. And he refers to Naomi Klein's incredible book and says, the shock doctrine was also turned into a hit movie, I believe, called Fight Club, but don't quote me on that. Then he says that the shock doctrine basically says that the rich and powerful, our rulers bereft of empathy or moral codes, exploit any crisis like disasters, natural and otherwise, to force through controversial, draconian, profit-based, or flat-out offensive policies and laws, while the majority of the populace are too distracted, stressed, and drowning in anxiety to fight back adequately. Or to sum it in a different way, he says, when the shit hits the fan, rather than help people, the ruling thieves have a ball. And he mentions privatization of New Orleans schools after Katrina, selling off of Puerto Rico's power grid after Hurricane Maria, the Federal Reserve bailout of $29 trillion. That's a higher figure than I've heard, but I'll take it from Lee Camp. The Patriot Act. And he goes on to talk about how the oligarchs are working to get more money to socialize their losses. Profits are always private. That's the BlackRock way. EPA rules have been indefinitely suspended. The enforcement has. The Department of Justice wants to suspend certain constitutional rights. The Trump administration has moved to steal ancestral lands of a Native American tribe. That's in Rhode Island, the Mashpees. And he goes on. It's an excellent piece, and I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And I also want to forget those who are even below the lowest caste. People serving prison sentences. who are locked up and the key has been thrown away. And a distressing video was smuggled out of the federal prison called Elkton in Lisbon, Ohio. It's near Youngstown. And a courageous 31-year-old inmate named Aaron Campbell pleads with viewers to get the word out because, as of last weekend, three inmates have died from the coronavirus, 15 are in isolation, and more than 80 are in quarantine. He describes the absurdity of social distancing in the prison environment. And let's name these people. Last Thursday, a week ago, three inmates died, 53-year-old Woodrow Taylor, 65-year-old Margarito Garcia Fragoso, and 76-year-old Frank McCoy. Only the Oakdale Federal Correctional Institution in Louisiana has seen more deaths than Elkton, and their number is five. And so with that in mind, yesterday I announced the new Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. I am seeding it with my $1,200 loan from the government whenever I get it. I'll float the money until then. And for the next 60 days, all subscription revenues that you donate to support my podcast will go into the fund. Now, non-subscribers are also asked to contribute whatever you can, and we will acknowledge your contributions unless you ask to remain anonymous. So we are going to offer grants of $100, one per household. We ask you to describe, in general terms or explicitly if you like, what you need the money for. I will mention up to three requests per day and invite listeners to match or add to the grant coming from my fund. Now, if you listen to this podcast, we assume you are honorable, and we may reject some claims if it sounds a little fishy. I also want to mention that this is not limited to the United States. According to the Googles, about a third of my listeners are in other countries, and we have from time to time recorded downloads in 71 countries. So the first request came in last night from Pat Thomas, and he says he is in Florida, spelled with a D-U-H at the end. Melbourne, Florida. He says, I'm applying for your generous $100 grant. This would enable me to buy groceries. I'm disabled by chronic illness. For the last 45 years. I've been on Social Security disability since 1990. Now he's 68 and he qualifies for Social Security. He's got food stamps, Medicaid, Medicare. But with so few work hours due to being incapacitated, my monthly income is below poverty. Now, get this. You just heard the description of his needs. But what preceded his request was a PayPal contribution of $20. Now, Pat, I have had to institute a new rule. We will not accept contributions, even from people, you know, with a good intention, from somebody who's applying for a grant. And so later today, I'm going to go to PayPal. I'm going to refund your $20 and send you a $100 grant. And thanks for listening. I really appreciate that. And I hope that listeners will rally to this and create our own little fund that we can use to help other listeners who are in critical need at this time. I want to credit Joe Lauria. He's a friend. He's a man who has traveled the world. He lived in Iraq for a while during the U.S. occupation. He covered the United Nations for many years. He knows a lot of stuff. And he has provided the best detailed coverage of the developments in Saudi Arabia. Now, the New York Times has reported that there is a unilateral Saudi ceasefire order that has already taken effect today, related to their brutal war in Yemen, which has been going on for 5 years. And what is driving this is that there is a massive outbreak of infection from the coronavirus in the Saudi royal family. 150 members are reportedly infected. And the top dogs, the 84-year-old and probably vulnerable King Salman, and his brutal son, Mohammed bin Salman, well, they're taking ultimate protective measures. They have retreated to an island off the coast of Jeddah in the Red Sea. And they're leaving the rest of the royal family and the serfs, who are by all means well taken care of because of the oil revenues that have made Saudi Arabia a very wealthy nation with a relatively small population. Of course, most of their workers are serfs that come from outside the kingdom. So Laurier writes that Prince Faisal bin Bandar, who is the powerful governor of Riyadh and a nephew to the king, has the disease. He's in intensive care. And in all, 150 members are reported infected. The government said it's seeking the ceasefire because of its fear that the virus could spread in Yemen. I mean, give me a fucking break. They have 3,200, almost 3,300 cases identified in Saudi Arabia and 44 deaths so far. And a BBC report describing this unilateral ceasefire said that that it's embraced by the recognized government of Yemen, which is a fraud that Obama helped prop up when he was president and these hostilities began. But the Houthi rebels, they smell a rat. They think that this is an effort by the Saudis to use the pandemic to expand their control of territory and to dismantle the Houthi movement, the resistance. To date, there are no reported cases of coronavirus in Yemen, but it's not clear to me whether the recognized government or the Houthis have closed the borders to Saudi Arabia to try to protect their ravaged nation, which suffers from huge food shortages. Starvation is a daily phenomenon in Yemen, and the U.S. contributes to that by supporting the Saudi attacks with intelligence from our aircraft and satellites, and of course resupplying them with American munitions in transactions that Trump brags about. Oh, and the Times reports that there is a potential deal between the Saudis and Russia in the oil price war that has been underway for several months. And as Scott Ritter told us in the interview that I think is unrestricted now, you should be able to listen to that if you're not a subscriber, that this is an effort to take out the recent dominance developed here by the United States in the world oil networks. At any rate, there is this possible deal. But, of course, a week ago, Trump tweeted about a possible deal, and there was nothing to it. As I pointed out, it's an abuse of Twitter that caused the markets to shoot up. That happened again today, and oil prices are moving up as well. The rumor, really, because it's not confirmed, is that they are discussing cuts of about 10 million barrels a day in production, about 10% from normal. But there's already a huge glut, and reports indicate that the storage capacity is near 100%. So they're going to start filling up tankers and just having them anchor in places until they're able to manipulate the market into a more profitable zone. Here's today's COVID-19 update, compiled by Linda Lewis, and she's volunteered to do this, and I really appreciate it. She now reports from Johns Hopkins University, worldwide, nearly 1.5 million confirmed cases, 92,000 deaths in the United States, 364,000 cases, and 15,774 deaths. And this is where we get to the point I raised a little earlier. New research indicates that the coronavirus began to circulate in New York by mid-February, weeks before the first confirmed case, and it was brought to the region mainly by travelers from Europe, not Asia. Research teams at NYU and Mount Sinai Hospital analyzed genomes from the coronaviruses taken from New Yorkers starting in mid-March, revealing a previously hidden spread of the virus that might have been detected if aggressive testing programs had been put in place. And you know, the last day of January, Trump raised his own Great Wall to China, barring foreign nationals from entering the country. Once again, his biases and his existing conflicts drove his conclusion because he doesn't need facts. And Linda briefs us that she managed to watch Trump's White House performance yesterday, and that Secretary of State Pompeo made a rare appearance. And Linda says in her observation, he stepped carefully to avoid any statement that might antagonize China, possibly doing damage control for Trump's earlier comments. So she cites a reporter to Pompeo. Do you feel like China withheld critical information from the U.S. and there will be consequences? Pompeo, this is not the time for retribution, but it is the time for clarity and transparency. We're still working on this problem set. There's still data that these good people need so they can perform, I guess he's referring to Fauci, they can perform their analysis. So every country, China included, every country needs to be transparent about what's going on in their country. They need to share that data. We share ours with the world so the best scientists can get to the right conclusions. You can see how he's dancing around that. Follow-up. Should they have shared that data sooner? Pompeo. Every country has an obligation to share that information. We'll leave for another time how everyone did in that. Then, the recent threat from Trump that he would cut funding to the World Health Organization? A question to Pompeo from a reporter. The WHO has a fundraising drive of about $700 million for coronavirus resources. China has only donated $20 million. The U.S. has actually donated less. And this is more fodder for my description of the economic caste system. So the question to Pompeo, do you feel that China should be giving more? And do you have comments on a donation from the U.S.? And he responds, at this point, we're reevaluating our funding with respect to the WHO. This is very consistent with what President Trump has said since the beginning of his campaign. Organizations have to work. They have to deliver the outcomes for which they were intended. Then, in another exchange between a reporter and Trump, ABC is reporting our intelligence community was warning about the virus as early as November and produced a detailed report about the outbreak in China. When did you first learn about the intelligence, and could you have acted on it then? Well, I learned when I started, this is Trump, when I learned about the gravity of it was sometime just prior to closing the country to China. That's January. And when we closed up the flights coming in from China and various other elements, and then, as you know, we closed up to Europe, so I don't know exactly, but bullshit. Okay, then regarding the memos from Peter Navarro, a reporter. Yesterday, you had not seen Navarro's memo on coronavirus back to January 31st and first, and a second one on Feb 23. Were you ever briefed on those memos? Did you ever discuss them? Trump, I don't remember that. I've now seen the memo. I saw it. Peter sends a lot of memos. I didn't see the memo. As you know, World Health Organization was saying that was not correct because at the time they called it wrong. So look at this whiplash. At one moment, we're talking about his threats to the WHO, and then he blames them for his refusal to read memos, to take them seriously, and to take any action. So then Vice President Pence pumped up some blue sky In Detroit, the Henry Ford Hospital is conducting a clinical trial for hydroxychloroquine. And he said they had a rather overwhelming response to the initial trial, which is beginning this week. So people want it. But, at least in Linda's notes here, no mention of the side effects that can be fatal or cause other pretty strong reactions. And then later in the briefing, Dr. Fauci was asked about the disparities, how in Louisiana, Chicago, and Detroit, the early data show that African Americans are bearing the brunt of this, with disproportionate deaths related to their populations. And I will note here that many states have not compiled or at least released the breakdowns of the impact of the virus by race. So Fauci, it is very painful to see, and I've seen it through my entire career, that the health disparities in the minority community, particularly African American community, puts them at risk. Puts them at risk for diseases much more so than the general population. The double whammy that we suffer now is when you have this terrible virus, which essentially preys in its ultimate effects on people with those underlying conditions. And since that's more predominant in the African-American population, we want to double down. And he said, you're not going to solve the issue of health disparities this month or next month, but we do need to address it. And the head of the CDC was trotted out to offer at least a sketch of how people can, the serfs, can safely return to work. You have to take your temp before you go to work, wear a mask at all times, practice social distancing, stay home if you're sick, don't share objects, don't touch your face, and don't congregate in break rooms. Yeah, that'll fix it. Yesterday, another high death count in New York, 799 people died related to the virus, raising the death count to close to 7,100. If you want to call it good news, there are fewer hospital admissions being reported, meaning that at some point, if that trend continues, we could see not just the flattening, but a decline of the proverbial curve. Now, Pennsylvania, with a focus on Philadelphia, has seen a jump in new cases. The number of cases in the Keystone State has doubled in a week, up from 7,000 on April 2nd. The number of known deaths has also surged more than threefold. It was 90 on April 2nd, and it is now 338. Also, there's an interesting piece by a pair of reporters, lower-ranking people I haven't seen before, in the Washington Post. And they take some of the comments and representations that have come from Trump in these extended showboat briefings. And my summation is that Trump, who now admits that he's a cheerleader, and he offers a lot of, rosy predictions, including that, everything's going to be fine by Easter, which is Sunday, as many people know. And the cheerleader mixes lies and blue skies, in my humble opinion. And they state the president and his top political aides have repeatedly used the televised briefings to describe efforts and actions that have not panned out. Going back to the claim that Google was going to run this testing system, they misrepresented the scope of it, and it's still in its earliest stages. Not even the two counties where Google is centered, San Mateo and Santa Clara counties, have any kind of full program that Google has sketched so far. And this came as a surprise to me. The $1,200, the direct payments to American families, will not land in your bank account or your mailbox, in many cases, until September. The hospital ships are great television, but the feds initially refused to allow COVID patients to be treated there. Trump said that the crisis would disappear, that it was a Democrat hoax, and he rewrote his own lies to claim that it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. He has misstated the scope of travel restrictions, made false claims about the use of the Defense Production Act. And meanwhile, the Trump campaign issued a list, and I saw it on Facebook. It was posted by a guy, and I don't know why I accepted his friend request. He fired me from one of my favorite radio jobs back in the late 80s. His name is Carl Dickens. He has a Dickensian view. He never explicitly calls himself a Trump supporter, but the only thing he posts, the things he posts, are Trump propaganda. And last week he popped up with this campaign list of 120 actions. And every bullet point said, President Trump did this and President Trump did that. And he takes credit for everything, even things he was forced to do by the Democrats or by the science experts. Thanks again to Linda for her report today. Here in California, we've had 68 deaths in the past 24 hours, which brings us over the 500 mark. And while Governor Newsom, I think, has handled the situation very well, and we have, according to the data to date, limited the spread of the virus in remarkable ways. But I was a little uncomfortable this week when he announced that he is loaning 500 ventilators to the federal, to Jared's stockpile. And they're being shipped to New Jersey and other places where I do believe they're needed. And this raised a red flag from Riverside County. If you don't know about Riverside and San Bernardino counties, they're called the Inland Empire, about an hour east of Los Angeles. And these are huge geographical counties with growing populations. And Riverside has 1,100 cases, 32 deaths, an outbreak at a nursing home that forced evacuation of the patients because the sickened staff failed to show up for 2 days in a row. They have made two requests to Sacramento for ventilators. The first was denied. The second is pending. And Newsom went on Rachel Maddow's show the other night to talk about a big deal that he made, and it is a breakthrough. He made a deal that over the next few months, he didn't reveal where they're coming, other than to say that it's offshore. $150 million of the N95 respirator masks and $50 million surgical masks per month. And he's willing to share that once he is assured that the state of California has adequate supplies. Now, I think Melania Trump is wise to stay out of sight most of the time. Some of the White House tell-all books say that she rarely overnights at the White House. She shows up during the day for events and lives with her parents in a Washington, D.C. mansion, a suburban mansion. And she's kind of moved on from her Be Best anti-bullying campaign, which is wise considering how much bullying Trump is doing these days. But she posted a video on Twitter today advising Americans to wear face coverings in public. And we've now confirmed the full quote. And I'll read it to you and then explain why I held back in saying this. But last Friday, when Trump said that he's recommending that people wear masks, he said, "But I won't be doing so. I think wearing a face mask as I greet presidents, prime ministers, dictators, kings, queens, I don't know. Somehow I just don't see it for myself. I just don't." Well, the thing I held back on was I thought dictators was an added term that came from some wag in social media. But this is a direct quote from the New York Times. And tell us, Don Boy, how many presidents, prime ministers, queens, or dictators are trying to get in to see you in the White House these days? In kind of brutal irony, last October, the toady government of Hong Kong, which is submissive to Beijing, imposed a ban on face masks being worn in public in Hong Kong, one of the most densely populated communities on Earth. And this was to prevent the protesters from disguising their identity and surviving waves of tear gas. But a court in Hong Kong delivered a judgment Thursday, which was yesterday our time, saying that Hong Kong's chief executive could use colonial-era laws to make emergency decrees for public safety, and that banning masks was constitutional at unlawful gatherings. But it also found that banning masks at lawful gatherings and allowing police to demand their removal is unconstitutional. Well, that's nice. I don't imagine that it will have any effect. So this morning on the way to the secret studio, I popped on to the Rush Limbaugh radio show. And he's the guy who gets so much sympathy because he's got stage 4 cancer. And he is in his last days or weeks, months, I don't know. And I don't wish him any ill will. I just wish he'd have more compassion for people who don't make 30 or 70 million a year, whatever it is, and don't live in a Palm Beach mansion. But get this. I heard him trying to follow these talking points that are coming from Fox and other right-wing media. That, you know, when you look at the data, it's all exaggerated, and they're claiming that COVID killed people who didn't really get killed by COVID. And basically, he's saying that the underlying conditions are why people died and not the virus. And you could make an argument about that, but at this point, it's just cruel rhetoric. But what I heard him say was he actually criticized the Dear Tweeter. And he said that, you know, Trump's always been anti-science and, you know, it's one of his major campaign themes. And he slammed Trump for letting Fauci and Birx revise projections, he said, without accountability. And I just think that is so rich, even richer than Rush frickin' Limbaugh. Because Trump gets to revise his own recent comments and history, sometimes multiple times, whenever he wants. Just one recent example, he threatened to cut U.S. funding to the WHO, and 20 minutes later he said, oh, I never said that. So it falls to Dr. Anthony Fauci to dismiss these conspiracy theories. And you know I'm touchy about that term. But he said there's absolutely no evidence that that's the case at all. I think it falls under the category of something that's very unfortunate, these conspiracy theories that we hear about. Anytime we have a crisis of any sort, there's always this popping up of conspiracy theories. Britt Hume is in on the action. He went on Tucker Carlson's show on Tuesday to say that any person with the virus is being counted as a COVID-19 death, regardless of what else may be wrong. And that little mother, Tucker, said, there may be reasons people seek an inaccurate death count. When journalists working with numbers, there sometimes is an agenda. And this account quotes Limbaugh, previously dismissing the virus as similar to the common cold, but changed tack to recently claim it's admittedly speculation. But what if we are recording a bunch of deaths to coronavirus that really should not be chalked up to it? Always deflecting and minimizing. One of the other victims, if you will, of the economic downturn, the sharp reduction in advertising because of the layoffs attributed to the pandemic, one of America's great newspapers, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, announced another round of layoffs, reducing the union news reporter staff to only 14. And as part of a long-running union-busting scheme, the Plain Dealer has a second outlet, which is a web-based media platform called Cleveland.com. So there are only 14 remaining union news writers and reporters, and they are now banned by the management from covering stories in Cleveland and Cuyahoga County and neighboring Summit County. They have been transferred to Siberia. They are in a newly created bureau that covers the backwaters, Geauga, Lake, Lorain, Medina, and Portage counties. And this reminds me of what the San Jose Mercury News did to the celebrated prize-winning reporter Gary Webb for his exposure of Iran-Contra and the cocaine Contra connection. After he fell out of favor because the editors got so much pressure, Gary Webb was assigned to a newly created bureau in the little town of Cupertino, which is really Apple City. And he later quit in disgust. Elizabeth Warren has stepped up with another plan. There's some good elements to it. And is she auditioning for Joe Biden for the vice presidency after she hit him pretty hard in some of the final debates she was in? I will also note that Kamala Harris is auditioning. She held a virtual fundraiser to introduce Joe Biden to her moneybags donors. And Warren and Harris are top-ranked in speculation about who Biden might pick. Well, I would lean to Warren, although, just in political science terms, Biden is likely to carry Massachusetts with or without Warren. If she became vice president, her replacement would be appointed by a Republican governor. And those are considerations that must be taken into account. So Warren calls for suspending consumer debt collection, enacting a universal national moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, stopping water and utility shutoffs. Now, most of this has been happening, at least here in California, at the state or local level. And what she doesn't include is one of the biggest burdens that people face at this time. We know that many families rely on credit card debt to get by. Now their incomes are either cut off or sharply reduced. The unemployment money may start to flow in a few weeks. It may take longer. We just heard the speculation that the $1,200 won't even come, and it's a loan against your taxes next year, until maybe September. And these big banks are benefiting from the bailouts. And I believe that they should sharply reduce interest rates. Money is almost free, Trump tells us. But the serfs who have heavy credit card debt are paying 18 to 20%. And I believe that that is, should be included in Elizabeth Warren's plan. She has other good ideas, and we'll see where all that goes. Bill Barr went into the hostile territory of Fox News and had a chat with Laura Ingraham, and he has declared that Russiagate and the Mueller investigation amount to one of the greatest travesties in American history. Quote, without any basis, they started this investigation of his campaign, and even more concerning, actually, is what happened after the campaign, a whole pattern of events while he was president to sabotage the presidency, or at least have the effect of sabotaging the presidency. And as you know, I'm quite sympathetic to parts of that argument. I think that Russiagate was ginned up by the Democrats first to explain Hillary's loss, and then they thought, well, this is a way to put a leash and a nice collar on Trump. And I consider the Mueller report to be a limited hangout whitewash that embraced the unproven conspiracy that was advanced by the intelligence community in their reports in October of 16 and January of 17. But where's the evidence, Bill? He set up this investigation with Dunham, and we haven't seen anything from it. So, Bill, put up or shut up. I want to recommend a podcast that I released way back on March 20th over at Who, What, Why. And at the time, Mike Bloomberg was a thing. He was unloading bucket loads, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of his fortune to try to buy the presidency. And one of the most offensive things that he had said, in defense of his stop-and-frisk policies while he was mayor of New York, he flatly said that male minorities aged 15 to 25 are responsible for 95% of the murders. And so I interviewed author Ann Kim, who wrote a book called Abandoned. And among other things, we talked about Bloomberg and the way that there is a whole group of people in that age group who are really unseen. Many are homeless. Once they, you know, exhaust their, well, they reach what's called majority and they're no longer foster kids, they're just dumped out on the streets. And I hope you'll listen. I think it's an important argument that she makes. Well, now it's safe to praise Bernie Sanders, especially from the milquetoast Democrats who worked so hard to elbow him out of the presidential race. Here's one from Nick Goldberg, columnist at the LA Times. I've never supported Bernie Sanders. I believe that he could not win a general election campaign against a Republican candidate, and that if by some miracle he did, he wouldn't be able to fulfill the broad-sweeping, intoxicating promises of his utopian campaign. But Goldberg says he misses him. And he cites the frequent comments from Sanders on the campaign trail about the moral outrage that three people in America own more than the bottom half. Healthcare should be a right, not a privilege. If you work 40 hours, you shouldn't be living in poverty. Embracing efforts to deal with climate change. And he says he praises him, or faintly praises him. Each of these statements is true, obvious, and unapologetically stated. And it's no accident that two of them refer to moral outrage, which was at the core of Sanders' message, and I suspect his character. And then he dismissed him because he made promises that he was unlikely to deliver on. And, you know, this is just so absurd because we have seen that in order to bail out corporate America, they suddenly found the ability to borrow trillions of dollars. But you could never do that to provide universal coverage like Medicare for all. No, that didn't draw the attention of Nick Goldberg. A better piece by Eric Locke appears in the New Yorker online today. And he compares the two New Yorkers, Trump and Sanders. The hope that Sanders inspired on the left became directly related to the despair that Trump provoked. Trump sought to bring about a conservative kleptocracy in which power justified itself and a white-centric vision of what it means to be American was celebrated. Sanders wanted to address the inequality that continues to plague the country through wars, financial crises, and actual plagues. There's more. I've linked to it in the show file at peterbcollins.com. I also recommend Sam Husseini's piece published at Mint Press News today. He does a good job of articulating some of the good and bad of the Sanders campaign. But he opens with this, a quote from Kyle Kalinske of Secular Talk. Bernie made a number of mistakes that I highlighted and broke down in detail. No excuses. Having said that, you're out of your fucking mind if you think I'll forget or look past Bloody Monday, the day that Obama got Pete and Amy to drop out and endorse Biden, saving his campaign. And Sam Husseini adds some other points, some of which I made in my commentary yesterday. But he closes by recommending that people who don't want to vote for Biden and clearly would never vote for Trump should engage in what he calls the vote pact strategy. And it basically means that you team up with somebody who will offset your vote, like a Republican family member. And you agree that they won't vote for Trump, either by not voting for president or choosing a third-party candidate, and that you won't vote for Trump and adopt one of those other options. I think it's interesting, and I may avail myself of it. I wanted to just add a couple of things to my lengthy dissection of the Sanders campaign and the roadblocks thrown up by the Democratic establishment. And I had it in my notes, but I don't think I emphasized enough that the exit polls in as many as 15 states showed troubling disparities between those exit polls and the actual reported vote count. And this is a serious issue, and to his discredit, Bernie Sanders never fought these issues. He didn't do it in 2016 with the obvious rigging. After the election, he never acknowledged that the Podesta emails clearly showed that the insiders at the DNC were all working to block him. And the other point that I either didn't mention or didn't emphasize enough is that the prediction, the bet that Bernie made that young voters would turn out really didn't materialize, and I can't properly explain that. The allergy to democracy and to full participation in elections that afflicts Republicans is coming into very clear view. And at Who, What, Why, Gabriella Novello does a good job of quoting Trump over on Fox and Friends last week. If Democrats, this relates to converting the election this fall to all mail-in balloting. And he said, well, if you do that, Democrats would have levels of voting, and you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again. And his comments are repeated in another quote. I think mail-in voting is horrible. It's corrupt, says Trump. You get thousands and thousands of people sitting in somebody's living room signing ballots all over the place. Now, we know that the provable case of manipulation of mail-in ballots favored a Republican in the 10th Congressional District in North Carolina to the degree that even the Republicans who run the rigged system in North Carolina were so embarrassed that they completely dismissed that election and ran a new one. And North Carolina is where State Senate Leader Phil Berger openly admitted his opposition to a recommendation by the state's Board of Elections to move toward voting by mail. And in Georgia, the Republican House Speaker David Ralston called mail-in voting extremely devastating to Republicans and conservatives. Widespread use of absentee by-mail voting in the primary would hurt Republican candidates. Well, we certainly got to keep the rigging and suppression going. And the inarticulate leader of the Republicans in the House, Kevin McCarthy from Bakersfield, California, he harshly criticized Pelosi for suggesting that vote by mail should be expanded. That's disgusting to me, he said. He was talking to Trump, and he knows that's one of Trump's favorite terms. Gail Collins, no relation to yours truly, in the New York Times today, says, well, we've got the candidates for 2020. Now all we have to do is make sure we have an election. Are you worried about this? She says. The huge mess in Wisconsin this week showed what can happen if you mix a pandemic, an already confusing voting system, and partisan politics. Well, that's true, but the Democrats colluded on that to a great extent, thinking, in my view, that it would benefit Joe Biden. And we still don't know the outcome of that election. I think it'll be next week sometime. I highly recommend Glenn Greenwald's latest piece at The Intercept. He's been focusing more on Brazil, where he lives. But he notes that right after Bernie Sanders terminated his campaign, people are already running a shaming campaign against those who are contemplating abstaining from voting due to dissatisfaction with the two major party candidates. And he says this shaming rests on a caricature. It is designed to suggest that the only people who make a deliberate and conscious choice not to vote due to dissatisfaction are white trust fund leftists whose wealth, status, and privilege immunize them from the consequences of abstention. But he goes into great detail, breaking down Pew Research reports from recent years. And he says those who choose not to vote because of dissatisfaction with the choices are disproportionately poorer and non-white, while rich whites vote in far larger percentages. And the data makes clear that the primary motive for non-voting among these demographic groups is not voter suppression, but a belief that election outcomes do not matter because both parties are corrupt or interested only in the lives of the wealthy. Now, I want to clarify here that he is correct, because voter suppression doesn't really affect people who choose not to vote. But it is highly impactful on those who are registered and do intend to vote, who happen to be a minority and likely to vote Democratic, among other reasons. So from Pew, non-voters were more likely to be younger, less educated, less affluent, and non-white. And it's because they've given up. They don't have faith in the system. They don't find a candidate who speaks to them. And more than half of those who didn't vote on purpose earn less than $30,000 a year. More than half of those who did vote were over the age of 50. There's much more data here, and while some of it conflicted with some of my own biases, I think it is sterling commentary and analysis from Mr. Greenwald. Today, we recognize the passing of Linda Tripp, the universally almost reviled figure who led to Bill Clinton's impeachment. And let's recognize that the origins of the Get Clinton effort started with David Brock, the Arkansas Project, and the spending of Richard Mellon Scaife, the Pittsburgh oligarch, who funded an effort to get Clinton in any way they could. And finally, Linda Tripp revealed her illegally recorded phone calls with Monica Lewinsky, who shared her secret about giving sex but not receiving it, with the President of the United States. So, bye-bye, Linda Tripp. And I truly mourn the passing of Mort Drucker. I got to interview him one time. He was the central cartoonist at Mad Magazine. And I guess I'm dating myself because Mad shut down a few years ago, and it had become generally irrelevant. But when I was a kid in the 60s, we had to struggle. I have four brothers, and we all loved Mad Magazine. We read every page over and over again. And when the new issue came out, we'd run to the newsstand to get it because Dad wouldn't let us get a subscription. It was almost considered porn by our parents, but it wasn't. It was very gentle, deft, topical humor. It wasn't particularly political or partisan. But in features like Spy versus Spy that sent up the Cold War, Mad Magazine was a very important influence on your humble host. And when I got to meet Mort Drucker, it was in the 90s. He was then, I guess, in his 60s because he died at 91 yesterday. It was a real highlight of my life experience. Mort Drucker, happy trails. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.